Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
From global current affairs to art, science and culture, the documentary from the BBC World Service tells the world's stories. Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 20th of April, these are our main stories. Gunfire has continued across the Sudanese capital despite a fresh ceasefire attempt. Russia has rejected allegations that it's using spy ships in the North Sea to sabotage critical European infrastructure. Children of women murdered in Chile by their partners are to receive reparations from the state until they're 18 years old. Also in this podcast,
I got this feeling inside my bones. It goes electric, baby.
While listening to this could make your food taste sweeter. We start in Sudan, where fighting appears to be continuing in the capital, Khartoum, despite the latest ceasefire attempt. Nearly 300 civilians have been killed in 5 days of clashes between the Sudanese army and a rival paramilitary group whose leaders are locked in a power struggle. As we record this podcast, witnesses reported hearing gunfire. Thousands of residents have fled the city, but many remain trapped in their homes, while the few hospitals still open are struggling to treat the large numbers of wounded. Dr. Ahmed Abbas told the BBC the situation was dire.
People are dying from lack of staff, lack of blood supply, lack of intravenous fluids. Some of them are dying because of the long wait to get into either the operating rooms or to get even to the wards.
Some foreign nationals are also trapped inside Sudan because of the fighting. Here's one message the BBC received from an Indian man stuck in Khartoum.
Hi, I am Tanzil. I am from India. I had come to Sudan for a work-related project and I was supposed to go back to India tomorrow. Due to an armed conflict, I am stuck here in Khartoum with very limited access to food, water and electricity. Despite the 24-hour truce that started, there is heavy gunfight going on and it is impossible to go out and look for supplies.
Earlier, the Sudanese army had said it would abide by the latest humanitarian ceasefire, the second in 2 days, as long as the rival paramilitary rapid support forces did the same. Ferdinand Amondi from BBC Africa is monitoring events in Sudan from Nairobi, and he told us more about the latest ceasefire.
I have spoken to some residents in here who are my friends, holed up in their homes, saying they can still hear sporadic gunshots in some parts of Khartoum. Several reports from the area are also showing that the ceasefire is not holding. And this is the fourth in 5 days, 2 3-hour ceasefires and now 2 24-hour ceasefires that seem not to be holding. While this is happening, hospitals which are supposed to treat the sick and injured are overrun. Khartoum has nearly 60 hospitals, and out of them, only five operating. These have also been hit by bullets, and they're also running out of crucial supplies like water and even oxygen for the ICU.
So a dire situation in the few hospitals that are still open. We know that thousands of civilians are fleeing, but many are still trapped in the city.
Yes, they are. And it's not just, you know, the nationals, but even foreign countries are unable to evacuate their people. India is the latest country to confirm that it has sought permission from the military to evacuate its citizens. But the problem is the airport has not yet been secured for the people in there. There are very many people who've been wanting to get out. The UN, Africa Union, and even IGAD, which is the Regional Intergovernmental Authority on Development, has been calling for a ceasefire so that the people who want to get out can get out. But what I'm gathering also from the people I've spoken to, they can't even go to the shops to buy food because they don't know whether they'll get shot. There has been people who've been caught up by stray bullets, but also the international community has been criticizing both the military military and rapid support forces of, you know, targeting civilians.
Ferdinand Amondi. We told you in an earlier podcast about a new documentary that claims that Russian spy ships disguised as fishing trawlers are looking for power lines and communication cables in the North Sea that they can sabotage in the event of a war. Moscow has denied the allegations, which were made in the report produced in Scandinavia and Finland. My colleague, James Menendez, heard more from Niels Fastrup from the Danish Broadcasting Corporation, who was part of the team who conducted the investigation.
We found that Russia has a secret military program running right now, which is about using a huge number of both military but also civilian ships to map European, Nordic, UK infrastructure in order to, in the event of an escalation in the current conflict, to prepare for sabotage in order to be able to paralyze the ability of, say, the UK society or Danish society to function. So that's basically the short version of it, yes.
And to sabotage, so what, communications cables? Wind farms in order to disrupt energy supply?
Our sources tell us that they are mapping, for instance, communication cables, but also power cables or offshore wind farms in order to be able to shut down communication, shut down the internet, but also cut off power supplies, gas supplies, etc.
One of the reporters on the team approached one of those ships. What happened?
Well, that was me, actually.
It was me.
That was a vessel belonging to the Baltic Fleet, the Russian Navy, based in Kronstadt out of St. Petersburg. We went there to film it when it sailed through Danish waters in November last year, because according to our sources, it was on an intelligence gathering mission. When we were outside approximately 100 meters or so away from the vessel, armed crew members came out and showed us that they were armed, and so we backed off from the scene.
Is there any evidence that any sabotage has already been taken place that you found?
As part of our project, Nordic project, we are investigating an incident last year or the year before in Norway, where some internet cables running between Svalbard, the Norwegian islands north of Norway, and the Norwegian mainland, they were damaged or even maybe cut. And according to our investigation, a number of Russian fishing vessels sailed in a suspicious manner above the incident or the place where the incident took place. And so experts assess, you're looking at our findings, that this might be Russian sabotage against these internet cables.
And what do you mean by a suspicious manner? What does that look like in practice?
That will be like maybe you sail across the same cable 140 times or so in a way that is not in conformity with how the way you would sail if you were fishing.
Can you just explain how these plans would be used and how you came to find out that this is sort of, these are plans that have been drawn up in case the Ukraine conflict were to spread more widely?
According to our sources, which includes a significant number of Nordic and Western intelligence sources, in the event of an escalation in the current conflict or in a future conflict between Russia and NATO, part of Russia's war plans would be to sabotage infrastructure, say, in the North Sea. If you look at it, I mean, what characterizes Europe and the Western world is there's a lot of seabed infrastructure, and that is vulnerable because it's basically unprotected, so you would be able to go down there, you could cut internet cables, you could do huge amount of damage, you could cut power cables, you could knock off offshore wind farms. Some of the offshore wind farms currently being built outside the UK, they supply power for maybe more than 1 million households in the UK. So if you knock, say, 5 or 10 of those out, you do significant damage to UK society.
Niels Fastrup from the Danish Broadcasting Corporation. In the Middle Ages, what is now the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, was at the centre of a powerful empire. Kievan Rus encompassed a large swathe of Eastern Europe and is universally acknowledged as the birthplace of modern Russia. But Russian authorities have excluded mentioning it from their new secondary school history books. Sasha Slichter reports.
The 2021 textbook tells of Prince Vladimir conducting mass baptism in the Dnipro River in Kyiv in the 10th century. The new textbook drops Kyiv in favour of capital city. When referring to Prince Igor ruling Kyiv, the new textbook says simply Rus. 882, the year deemed to mark the formation of the ancient Russian state, has now been wound back by 2 decades. Soon after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, one of President Putin's advisers, an ex-culture minister, predicted that Russia would soon see history books written with account of this year's historic events. Russia, of course, is no stranger to rewriting history and even airbrushing archive photographs. Those who went to school in the 70s remember a picture of Lenin sitting on a bench, smiling and talking to an invisible man. That man, of course, was Stalin. Trotsky got airbrushed from every photo. The same happened to the murderous head of the secret police, who himself eventually got executed. School history books, too, had a long tradition of being re-edited in line with the prevailing winds. That was decades ago, in Soviet times. But now, this tradition is back.
Sasha Schlichter, there's been much debate about how to tackle the growing problem of femicide. Across the world, women are killed by partners or husbands who hold corrosive attitudes about their right to use violence when they are rejected or challenged. Now the government of Chile has approved a groundbreaking law that will give the children whose mothers are killed by femicide a monthly income of $200 until they turn 18. Our America's regional editor, Mimi Swaby, told us more about the plan.
For the first time, reparations are going to be paid to children of femicide victims. And this is part of efforts by the government of left-wing President Gabriel Boric to really challenge violence against women in Chile. The reparations legislation was first introduced by a feminist movement, Ni Una Menos, and relatives of femicide victims. More than 2 years later, the initiative was backed by the Ministry for Women and Gender Equality of the current government. And now it's received a broad support in Parliament, having 109 votes in favour and only 13 members voting against it. So under this new law, even female victims of attempted murder or attempted violence will also receive care and state benefits, allowing them not to work for up to a year after an attack. So it really is a support by the state as part of this approach to tackle the underlying issue of violence against women in the country.
And looking more widely across the region, how big a problem is femicide in Latin America?
It's a huge problem. So at least 10 women and girls have been murdered and at least 65 attempted femicides in Chile alone since the beginning of this year. But these aren't uncommon statistics. And far from the worst, rates of violence against women continue to surge across Latin America. Honduras has the highest rate of femicides. It's really an epidemic that's engulfed the whole region. There's a very chilling statistic saying that women are victims of femicide in Latin America every 2 hours.
Mimi Swaby. And now, one of the most contentious subjects in US politics, a woman's right to an abortion. On Wednesday, the US Supreme Court, which had been due to rule on whether to restrict access to an abortion pill, asked for a few more days to consider the highly contentious issue. This comes less than a year since the court, which has a majority of conservative judges, struck down the national right to abortion. The decision is thought to have been a major factor in the Democrats' strong showing in the midterm elections. Alina Salganikov is a director of women's health policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation in California. She told my colleague, Rajini Vajanathan, more about this latest case brought by anti-abortion groups.
Last November, November 2022, a newly formed anti-abortion organization called the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine challenged the FDA's approval of mifepristone, which is one of the two drugs that is taken in the United States to end a pregnancy before 10 weeks.
And this is a drug which is used in more than half of abortions in the country, so many women rely on it.
They are estimating that upwards of 5.6 million women have used mifepristone since it was approved in the year 2000. This drug has been used safely and effectively in the United States for 23 years now.
So what are the arguments against it then?
Well, the FDA, the federal government, is basically saying that the process was a good process, a fair process, and that there is a very long and established safety record for this drug, that you can't undo an FDA approval. That is a very complicated process. And in fact, the pharmaceutical industry has gotten also involved with, you know, amicus briefs, friends of the court briefs, basically saying that this could potentially undermine the entire FDA process in the United States.
And so where does this leave the abortion debate in America? It comes a year after the national right to abortion was struck down.
This is one of many abortion lawsuits, both at the state and at the federal level. The issue of abortion access is not resolved in this country. We have 13 states that already fully ban abortion. There are other states that have attempted to ban abortion, but they are basically hung up in the courts at this time. And there on the other side, you also have many states that have upheld the right to abortion. So it's state to state. The complicating thing about this mifepristone lawsuit is that it has the potential to undermine access to medication abortion in states that have already enshrined the right to abortion.
Alina Salganikov from the Kaiser Family Foundation in California. And staying in the US, police in the state of Alabama have charged two teenage boys with murder after a shooting at a girl's 16th birthday party in which four people were killed and more than 30 others wounded. The two suspects are brothers aged 17 and 16. The shooting occurred in the town of Dadeville on Saturday. Jeremy Burkett, a sergeant from the Alabama Law Enforcement Agency, spoke at a news conference.
When you pull out a gun and you start shooting people, we're going to put you in jail because we're thinking about the families. We're concerned about the families. Somebody's got to start thinking about mama because I know I'm tired of it and everybody behind me's tired of it. We're tired of going to the mothers and having to tell them that these kids are not coming home.
Our U.S. correspondent Neda Torfik told us more about the impact this shooting had had on the town of Dadeville.
It's a small community of about 3,000 people, so really so many either knew someone who was in that building or has a connection to somebody who was in that building. And it's been a very emotional time for them. I mean, you've heard from LaTanya Allen. She's the mother of the young girl who was having her sweet 16 birthday party, and her brother died that day. And she said that she's had a piece of her heart ripped out, that instead of going to his graduation, you know, he was just due Phil Dowdle in a few days to graduate. He was going to go to college on a scholarship. She says now she's going to have to visit him at the cemetery. And so you've had, you know, three teenagers, a 23-year-old man who rushed to the scene because he had heard that there was potentially trouble. He also died in this. And so many people are just still wanting answers to why this happened.
And this is just the latest in a huge number of mass shootings. It feels like they're increasing all the time. I think officially it's already been more than 160. We're only this year and it's only April. Is there any hope of anything being done to try to resolve this?
You know, I think there you can just really feel the frustration in the United States. You know, not only is this, at least 165 mass shootings this year. I mean, just every other day, it seems like there's another case of gun violence, even if it's not a mass shooting. You know, we've had cases now of young adults being killed for going in the wrong driveway or ringing the wrong doorbell. So there is so much. You heard the emotion there in the presser. So much emotion right now in the country. But the problem is these divides are not really getting any better. You have those who want more gun control measures. On the other side, fear that it's just a way to take away guns from lawful gun owners. So it is such a divided nation at this moment on that topic.
Neda Torfik. Still to come on this podcast, a previously unknown coral reef has been discovered off the coast of Ecuador's Galapagos Islands.
It's a pleasure to share that we've discovered an old and vast coral reef. We've never found such extensive and developed coral reefs at this depth.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. 50 currencies, 170 countries, one account designed to take on the world. So whether you're taking on Rio or Rome, Miami or Mumbai, you'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies with no markups and no hidden fees. Join 15 million people and businesses who are going global with Wise. Learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/BBC.
Exploring the events shaping our lives through original documentary storytelling.
We'll hear arguments for Roe against Wade.
The documentary from the BBC World Service is a window onto the wider world.
The security situation in Europe has changed in the last couple of years dramatically.
Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Italy has one of the lowest birth rates in the world. Its population is predicted to shrink by nearly 9 million by the end of the century. Some have argued the solution to this lies with the thousands of African and Middle Eastern migrants arriving on Italian shores each month. But a close ally of the Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, has claimed this puts Italians at risk of what he calls ethnic replacement. From Rome, Sofia Battizza reports.
Francesco Lollobrigida is the right-hand man of the Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, and he's also her brother-in-law. He said the way to boost Italy's population was not by taking in more migrants, but by encouraging Italians to have more children. Italy has one of the world's lowest birth rates, and a significant number of births are now registered to non-native Italians. But for some, his warning about ethnic replacement echoes the so-called Great Replacement Theory, a racist, far-right conspiracy theory that claims there's a secret plan to substitute white people with non-white migrants. Mr. Lollobrigida's comments were described as white supremacist by opposition politicians, who accused him of imitating the fascist regime of Benito Mussolini. Giorgia Meloni, whose party has neo-fascist roots, has herself used the term ethnic replacement in the past, but not since becoming Prime Minister 6 months ago. She has tried hard to portray herself as a credible world leader and has surprised many European allies by taking a moderate stance on a number of issues, from Italy's budget to support for NATO and Ukraine. But critics say these latest comments reveal the true colours of a government, Italy's most right-wing administration for 80 years.
Sofia Battizza. A 13-year-old boy in Ohio has died after taking part in the Benadryl challenge, a viral challenge on the social media app TikTok. Jacob Stevens spent nearly a week on a ventilator after overdosing on the over-the-counter antihistamine in an attempt to induce hallucinations. His family say they want to warn other parents to monitor their children's online activity to make sure another child doesn't go through the challenge. The BBC's Jordan Kenny has been following the story, and my colleague James Reynolds asked him, what exactly is the Benadryl challenge?
This is an internet challenge that first came about in 2020. Now, Benadryl's an antihistamine that would normally be used to treat allergies like hay fever, for example. But this challenge became popular on TikTok, and it encourages people who are normally young people, like teenagers, to take large amounts of the drug, which can then lead to them hallucinating or tripping out, for example.
This isn't a new challenge. What are companies doing and others doing to prevent teenagers from doing this?
Well, we've heard from TikTok. The social media platform says it doesn't allow any content that shows or promotes dangerous activities or challenges. It does say, though, that it hasn't seen the trend, but that it's blocked searches related to the Benadryl challenge since 2020 and continues to remove any content that violates its guidelines. Benadryl themselves says it's aware of the challenge and describes it as dangerous and says it needs to stop immediately. The company stresses the medication should only be taken when following the instructions on the label. In its statement, it added that it's working with TikTok and other social media sites to remove any content that's showing the challenge.
And of course, we're speaking because someone died, Jacob Stevens. What has Jacob's family said?
Yeah, well, speaking to the media in the US, Jacob's dad, Justin Stevens, said that his son Jacob's death was the worst day of his life. He said Jacob's friends were filming him when he took the drugs. The family are now trying their best to warn other parents to keep an eye on their children's activity online. Justin Stevens says he's contacted lawmakers in their local area as well to try and get an age restriction introduced on buying a medication like Benadryl.
And that was Jordan Kenny. Scientists have discovered a previously unknown coral reef off the coast of Ecuador's Galapagos Islands. They say the ancient reef is around 2 kilometres long and teeming with marine life. Tim Allman has more on this exciting find.
The waters off the Galapagos Islands have always been full of wonder and mystery. And it seems there are always more secrets to be revealed. scientists have discovered a coral reef that no one knew even existed. 400 metres below the surface, almost pristine, sitting on top of an undersea mountain. A real moment of pride for one of the team who found it, marine researcher Stuart Banks.
It's a pleasure to share that we've discovered an old and vast coral reef. We've never found such extensive and developed coral reefs at this depth, and they're in their original state.
Which is more than can be said for some other coral reefs. Climate change and pollution is having a terrible impact on sea life. This mission in the Pacific Ocean, funded by a foundation named after Charles Darwin, is about exploration and protection, says Danny Rueda, director of the Galapagos National Park.
It's important because we're talking about pristine ecosystems that have never been studied before. Our commitment is to preserve the ecosystems and the biodiversity we found here.
Last year, Ecuador expanded the marine reserve, a special protected area around the Galapagos Islands, by 60,000 square kilometres. The authorities have discovered a new coral reef. They are determined to keep it.
Tim Allman. Shakespeare once described music as the food of love, but could music also increase our love of food? Scientists in Sweden have discovered that if you listen to certain music while you're eating, your food tastes sweeter. This raises the prospect that we could make our diets healthier just by changing the soundtrack while we're chewing. Alice Adley reports.
If you struggle to resist sweets, your diet may be missing a crucial ingredient, the pop star Justin Timberlake. Researchers have discovered that listening to certain music tracks can influence how food tastes, a phenomenon which could be exploited to create healthier meals. One finding is that higher tones tend to make sweets taste sweeter, meaning recipes for puddings and other treats could require less sugar. Energetic pop songs sung in higher registers appear to work particularly well as a calorie-free sonic seasoning. Johan Swan of Örebro University in Sweden, who led the latest study, said Justin Timberlake and chocolate go together very well. He adds that the effect is subtle but stands out when the music changes. He says that when you switch to a low-pitch hip-hop track, like Drake, you really notice the difference and the chocolate seems more bitter. So is he right? We got our taste testers, radio presenters Sarah Montagu and Nikki Segnit, author of The Flavour Thesaurus, to find out.
Was that long enough for you to get a sense?
I did get a different sense from the chocolate. So I thought that the first one tasted more astringent to me.
Okay, it shouldn't do.
Right, but that I was getting much more. I mean, this.
Okay, I'm going to entirely agree with you because the second clip, I got a real sharp, sort of what felt like a real hit of sweetness.
Okay, that was an unscientific experiment, but they did notice a change when the tone of the music was different. This phenomenon is already being exploited in China, as Oxford University psychology professor Charles Spence explains.
What we know for sure is that sonic seasoning works in the moment, in the instant. Not for everybody all the time, but for the majority of people when they first come across it. And already there are cafes, for example, in Beijing that are playing sweet music all day long so that they can reduce the sugar content in their drinks.
The findings, which are published in the International Journal of Gastronomy and Food Science, say much of the research has until now looked at relatively luxurious dishes and alcohol, but the new Swedish study suggests that the effect applies also to staple foods like bread. The research involved a specially composed soundtrack, a spiky, discordant track, with what sounds like a salt shaker rattling in the background. The participants most often linked it to the word salty. Researchers say if applied in the real world, using carefully chosen soundscapes in fast food restaurants to meet salt reduction goals, it could reduce deaths from strokes and heart disease.
Alice Adley. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.